Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, October 6, 2014, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call. Today, our teleforum topic is the opening of the U.S. Supreme Court term. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Very pleased to welcome today three experts to our call. We're going to hear from each of them, very brief opening remarks of about 5 minutes from each, then maybe some discussion among the three experts, and then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions. We'll hear first from Carrie Severino. She is Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Judicial Crisis Network. She will be followed by Professor Jonathan Adler. He is the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. And he'll be followed by Professor Stephen Vladek, who's Professor of Law at the American University Washington College of Law. And with that, let's get right to the substance with Carrie Severino.
Hi, thanks, Dean. Since we've got three different people talking, I think we're all going to just try to talk about some of the major themes or cases that we see, and obviously there's lots of room for other stuff to be discussed. I think one of the big themes that I see coming into this term, there's a lot of different cases, and maybe at least so far we don't have the big star case that we have had maybe in some of the previous terms when we had Obamacare or same-sex marriage or some of these big issues before the court. But I think there is an interesting theme of an expansion of the federal government and the administrative state in particular, and the court pushing back on that, or as we've seen in the past, and whether that's going to continue. There's a few cases that fit into that theme that I see. One of them is called Department of Transportation versus Association of American Railroads. It's often being shorthanded as the Amtrak case. This has to do with an interesting administrative law setup where you have an agency that is not, it's not just a question of Congress delegating authority to an agency to make regulations, and how far can they go in letting an agency, which is not Congress and not an elected body, make laws that are going to be binding on parties. The question is, in this case, they've delegated it to an agency working with Amtrak, which is technically a private entity and one of the players in the industry, obviously, to make the laws that are going to be regulating that industry. So people have compared it to having General Motors helping to write the laws that are going to regulate the transportation industry. Something just smells fishy about that as a matter of sort of self-dealing, on top of which there's complicated questions of can they involve private parties in this kind of regulatory rulemaking, and a question of whether Amtrak even is a private party or whether it's really a quasi-governmental agency. So I think there's some interesting nuances that are going to go into it, but I think it does highlight the question of how much should the government be delegating to other groups. Another case or set of cases that fits into that are Perez versus Mortgage Bankers Association and Nichols versus Mortgage Bankers Association. Those two deal with rulemaking that had to do with some rules governing overtime practices for different mortgage workers. The question here really has to do with to what extent can an administrative agency just change its rules? So one of the reasons that our system has our constitutional system provides for laws that are out there that have been passed by Congress and signed by the president is so that people have a sense of what your laws are and you know what your expectations are. And to a certain extent, agencies are making laws that do bind people if their interpretation of a law is giving real content to that. And so in this case, we have an agency that had one interpretation effectively of who was covered by a provision, and then without any notice and comment, switched interpretations. So it's pretty settled that they can make this interpretation ex ante without giving people notice and comment, but the question is now as they've done it, have they effectively created sort of a substantive rule here that they can't just go and change without notice to people? Is that's going to undermine the ability of people who are governed by the regulations to be able to run their businesses effectively? So again, it's another question of how do we feel about giving so much authority into the hands of an unelected body and a body that therefore is also not necessarily going to give the same kind of procedural protections that you would have if something was being debated on the floor of Congress, or at least by someone who you have a representative that you can call and yell at them if you feel like it's going the wrong way. And then I think one other that sort of fits into that theme, at least in terms of the expansion of government, is a case called Yates versus United States. That has to do with the use of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in their anti-shredding provisions to prosecute a man who did not shred documents, but instead effectively shredded fish. He was a fisherman and caught some fish that were underweight. He was stopped and was, they said, we'll meet you at the bank. We're gonna, and he was would have been subject to some kind of a fine for that. And the way he just dumped the undersized fish, effectively just destroying evidence. So while Sarbanes-Oxley prevents you from destroying tangible items, or covering up tangible items that are going to implicate you in things, it's clear that that was not what the law was intended to cover. They were thinking documents, not fish. And so I think that that's going to be an interesting thing, because it's again, the government kind of expanding past where we expected it to go. I think there's some really interesting cases that may be granted, but we can talk about what we have on the docket before us first, and then maybe talk about that a little bit later. I'll turn it over to our next speaker.
Okay, great. Before getting into some specific cases, I wanted to just make a few general comments about the court and its docket this term, particularly as we think about what happened last term. Last term, as a lot of commentators had noted, the court was surprisingly unanimous across a large number of cases. In fact, the court was unanimous in the judgment in a majority of the argued cases. And that had not happened since, I believe, 1940. And one of the reasons that's notable is that if we had been on doing this call a year ago and had been asked whether or not we thought something like that was possible, we all would have said that that would have been crazy, because looking at the sorts of questions that were on the court's docket, what ranging from the treaty power to Hobby Lobby and so on, we would have said there's no way across this wide range of cases is this court going to have a substantial amount of unanimity. This coming term, interestingly enough, it'd be easier to make a prediction about unanimity, because at least at first blush, we don't see a large number of cases on high-profile contentious issues. As Carrie already noted, there's a decent number of cases that involve administrative law questions, the cases she mentioned, as well as some separation of powers cases like Zivotofsky, which relates to whether or not Congress can require the State Department to to issue a passport saying that someone who was born in Jerusalem was born in Israel, which is Congress's position, or whether or not the State Department can merely write Jerusalem as an indication of the State Department's policy of neutrality on the question of Israel, of whether Jerusalem is part of Israel. That question is an important separation of powers question, something that's certainly very important to a lot of academics and others that focus on these issues, not the sort of thing to end up on the front page of the New York Times. Another case that relates to the themes that Carrie was mentioned is a case called Mock Mining, which involves whether or not an agency, in this case the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, can merely assert that it fulfilled the procedural requirements taking action against a regulated entity, or whether or not courts should actually scrutinize what the agency did to see whether or not it in fact fulfilled its procedural obligations. The one area where, in terms of what's already been granted, we might see a bit more attention or a bit more focus, political focus, is this court has taken already a significant number of election law-related cases for this term. There is an interesting redistricting case out of Alabama raising questions about what are permissible bases upon which states can shape congressional districts. There's a case out of Florida involving limits on the ability of judicial candidates, or those that are candidates for judgeships, whether or not they can solicit money themselves. The Florida bar does not allow candidates for judgeships to do so. There's a case challenging the redistricting commission that is used to set districts in the state of Arizona. And then the court has already certainly indicated at least some interest in a case out of Ohio. The Supreme Court by a vote of five to four without opinion last week, stayed a lower court injunction that would have prohibited some changes to the early voting period and processes in the state of Ohio. And that means that those changes will go in effect for the current elections. And then there are some other cases, voter ID case out of Indiana and a case involving voting changes in North Carolina, where petitioners have asked the court to stay those changes from taking effect. So certainly one area of potential controversy we could see are all these cases involving elections. But then as Kerry also noted, if we're going to see really high-profile cases, we may have to wait for additional grants. And I will now turn it over to Steve.
Great. Well, thank you, John. Thanks, Kerry. So this is Steve Vladek from American University. You know, John and Kerry already touched on what to me are some of the major themes and cases for the term. I just want to say one more word about the Zinotofsky case that John mentioned, because I actually think, especially now that the court has turned aside the 7 same-sex marriage cases that were denied this morning, I do believe Zinotofsky is probably the most important constitutional law case, at least on the court's docket thus far this term. As John mentioned, this is a classic Congress versus executive branch separation of powers dispute, where the president, the executive branch, has historically taken the position that Jerusalem is not part of Israel, that it's actually not part of any one country, to avoid pissing off any individual constituent in the Middle East, and where Congress in 2002 provided by statute that if a parents of a U.S. citizen born in Jerusalem want that child's passport or notice of birth abroad to say Jerusalem come to Israel, they have a right to have it say that. So it's a classic example of Congress saying litigants have a right to do one thing and the executive branch saying that actually violates our unilateral presidential power. And what's so telling about the cert grant here is that the D.C. Circuit, in the case below, had actually endorsed a very broad theory of executive power, basically holding that Congress has no power to legislate in the field of foreign affairs, even though the specific subject matter at issue here is passports, something that's historically within Congress's regulatory domain. So the fact that the court took this case, even though the government won, the executive branch won below, may suggest that they're not as comfortable with such a broad endorsement of executive power as the D.C. Circuit. I want to briefly talk about two other cases that are getting far less attention, but that I actually think are equally important for the future of basically litigation in the U.S. courts. And the first is a sleeper case called Armstrong versus Exceptional Child Center. This is a case out of Idaho that the court granted last Thursday. And in Armstrong, you have a question that is exactly what the court ducked 2 years ago. Basically, in Armstrong, Idaho has refused to reimburse Medicaid providers at a rate that is sufficient to satisfy something called the equal access provision of the federal Medicaid statute. And so you have these Medicaid providers who are suing and saying, you're violating federal law. The problem is that the Medicaid statute does not provide an express cause of action. And after and in light of the Supreme Court's 2002 decision in Gonzaga versus Doe, the lower courts have held that litigants also cannot use Section 1983 to enforce the equal access provision. Well, instead, the litigants in this case have sued for injunctive relief directly under the Supremacy Clause on the ground that the state of Idaho has no authority to enforce a state law that's preempted by federal law, and that the state law at issue here is preempted by the federal Medicaid statute. This was the exact question the Supreme Court granted certiorari on 2 years ago in a case called Douglas versus Independent Living Center, also out of the Ninth Circuit, although there it was California. And there was a 5-4 opinion by Justice Breyer that ducked the question on very narrow grounds, holding that a change in the administrative posture of the case had basically mooted it. But the 4-justice dissent by Chief Justice Roberts took a very narrow view of whether these kinds of remedies, whether a litigant should ever be able to sue under the Supremacy Clause to challenge a preempted state law if the federal law that is doing the preempting doesn't provide its own cause of action. So the fact that this issue is back before the court again suggests that there may now be a fifth vote for that position, which would be a very significant ruling for the future of federal civil remedies, and especially for something called the doctrine of ex parte Young and suits against state officers for injunctive relief. The other case I want to flag before turning it back to Kerry is a rather technical immigration case that the Supreme Court also granted last Thursday. It's titled Kerry versus Din. And this is a case about the doctrine of consular non-reviewability. So it's a mainstay of federal immigration law that the federal courts don't generally have the power to review when the executive branch denies a visa to a non-citizen abroad who's applying for legal status in the United States. what the complicating factor here is that in this case, there's a U.S. citizen who is trying to obtain a visa on behalf of her spouse. And the question is whether the U.S. citizen who is married to this spouse has any property interest in at least notice and some kind of basis for the grounds on which her spouse's visa was denied. The Ninth Circuit, relying on some language in a 1972 Supreme Court decision called Kleindienst versus Mandel, held that yes, in fact, on these very narrow circumstances where the visa applicant is married to a U.S. citizen, the U.S. citizen, not the visa applicant, has a due process right at least to know the grounds on which the visa was denied. The government vigorously objected, petitioned for certiorari, and now the case is up on before the Supreme Court on the question of which principle gives. The government's right to not have to provide the grounds for a visa denial, or a U.S. citizen's right to have, know the grounds on which her spouse is being denied access to a visa. So that's actually a really technical case, but potentially a very important one when it comes to the separation of powers along the lines of Zivotofsky and I dare say Armstrong. So those to me are the three big cases in addition to the ones that we heard about already, and I'll throw it back to Carrie.
All right, just actually to follow up on Stephen's point, I think that Armstrong case brings up an interesting theme of which Dean alluded to, of just the narrowing decisions and the court ducking issues. And I think we saw that in some cases last term where the court seemed like, for example, the big treaty case, Bond versus U.S., which they kind of converted into a sort of strange statutory interpretation issue in order to avoid making the big question. And I think there's another case, actually, that it wasn't maybe the court's fault that they didn't take it, but that they just recently granted that we may see, and that's Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus Inclusive Communities Project, and that deals with the Fair Housing Act and whether disparate impact applies in that context. So I just think that's interesting that a lot of times they try to dodge something. Zivotofsky is another example. They kind of dodged it a little bit. It's been up before. They dodged it kind of that time, and now they finally have to make the really hard decision. So maybe they can't dodge these things forever. This disparate impact case is interesting because they've granted it before. This was a couple of years ago in Magner versus Gallagher. There was a big brouhaha because DOJ ended up settling the case sort of on the eve of the oral arguments. And there was a lot of concern over whether that was appropriate. Tom Perez, who's now Labor Secretary, was involved in it. I don't know if that'll come up. If he is, he's been rumored to be an AG possibility. I don't know if that'll come back up. But there was questions about whether it was appropriate the way it was settled, or whether they were just trying to settle the case because they're afraid the Supreme Court will strike down the idea of having disparate impact in the Fair Housing Act. So I think this will be another interesting case to see. I don't know if we're ready to talk about cases that haven't been granted yet, but I think a huge one, mentioned that same-sex marriage so far has been totally denied, so that's actually this looming potential case that at least for now isn't before the court, but I think one that still looms is called the King case. There's the Halbig and King pair cases. It was the fastest circuit split in history this July, where within a few hours of each other, the D.C. Circuit struck down an IRS regulation that allowed certain subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. And the Fourth Circuit, within just a few hours, said, no, it upheld that same law, and now that's before the court. I think the government's brief is due October 3rd, so it probably will be up very shortly before them, and we'll be able to see what they do. This fits into a theme that we saw kind of in some previous terms going into this term. We'll see if it continues, which is the government making really extreme arguments in certain cases, from my perspective at least, trying to expand the ability to the authority of the executive in certain areas. So I think it fits in with last year with the NLRB versus Noel Canning case, where the administration tried to really expand the recess appointments power beyond where it's ever gone before. In this case, I think it would be a case of expanding, for political reasons, the IRS trying to expand a statutory, its own version of a statutory interpretation beyond the text of the statute in a way that certainly seems on its face to conflict with the text of the statute. And I think we'll see if the court continues to push back against that. The NLRB case was decided unanimously, so we'll see if the Supreme Court is going to continue in a strong role of trying to deny the president simply his claims to have the phone and the pen, and that will be enough. I think even his own appointees would recognize that that's not quite enough. That's not what the Constitution gives him in terms of authority. So I think that'll be an interesting one to see if that case gets taken up.
What is your best guess on procedurally what happens? I mean, if the en banc decision reverses the panel decision, there's no longer a split. Is that right?
That's correct. So the D.C. Circuit decision has been taken en banc. I think if the court decides to wait for that decision, it could take months easily and not get on this term. But I think it's also significant that recently the Pruitt case, Oklahoma, an Oklahoma district court, found that this law struck down the law along very similar lines, in fact, citing Helbig. And now the Tenth Circuit will take that up. So even if the D.C. Circuit kind of temporarily eliminates the split by reverse, and it's currently technically vacated because it's been taken en banc. So the split doesn't actually exist, but everyone knows that it's a potential. I think the Tenth Circuit could easily reignite that split. And I think the challenge is this is an issue that deals with whether subsidies are available for tens of millions, millions of individuals, which actually implicate tens of millions because the availability of subsidies, and obviously Jonathan knows more about this than I do, but the availability of subsidies means that tens of millions more would be subject to either the individual or the employer mandate. So there's a huge numbers of individuals and employers at issue in this case. There's huge amounts of planning that employers and that the health industry has to do to figure out what are its legal obligations. And I think it's an issue that would be the court really ought to consider, regardless really of the fact that there's a split, and particularly in light of the fact that it seems clear that a split is in the offing, even if it hasn't fully developed yet, either with the D.C. Circuit or with the Tenth Circuit, because it doesn't make sense to subject so many people to the insecurity of knowing whether what their obligations are. Do I need to purchase insurance? What my premium is actually going to be? It's better to have that decided. But I don't have a vote in that.
Professor Adler, you want to weigh in on this point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a mistake. I mean, first, I guess obvious disclosure. I am either credited or blamed, depending on your perspective, as being the authors of the legal theory upon which these cases are based. And I've been filing amici in these cases with my co-author, Michael Cannon. I think the court will – the brief – the government's opposition to certain King was filed on Friday. The court is scheduled to hear it in November or to decide whether to grant certain King in November. The D.C. Circuit en banc argument isn't scheduled for until December. Whether the court takes it, I think, is really a question of whether or not the court finds arguments about the reliance interests at stake to be sufficiently compelling. There's an argument that because a ruling against the IRS rule would put states in a position of having to essentially re-decide whether or not to create their own exchanges and thereby authorize tax credits, there is an argument that the sooner states are able to exercise that choice, the better off for states and everyone involved, because there are things in the statute that could make it difficult for states to fill that gap the more that time goes by. So if the court finds that argument compelling, that would be a reason to grant cert, even in the absence of a split prior to the D.C. Circuit's resolution en banc. As Carrie mentioned, a week or so ago, a district court in Oklahoma ruled against the tax credits. And then this Thursday, there will be oral argument in a fourth case in district court in Indiana, which is in the Seventh Circuit. But in district court, that oral argument will be heard on Thursday. Same challenges. That's a case brought by the state and by several school districts challenging the IRS rule. And so I think there's a decent chance that at some point the court will hear this. But the real question is how eager the court is to get this question, or whether or not, as in the same-sex marriage cases, the court's willing to sit back and see what lower courts do. Another issue that I don't think the court's in any rush to get to, but it may not have much choice, is the question of abortion. The court took a case last term, and then after certifying the question to the State Supreme Court of Oklahoma, dismissed the case. But there are several abortion cases involving state restrictions on abortion providers in one set of cases, or on the basis upon which doctors may prescribe the use of RU486, and whether or not they can prescribe it in ways that are considered off-label uses by the FDA. We have a split on some of these questions already, and if petitions are filed, I think we have a decent chance of the court taking one of those cases and reentering the debate over abortion. And then lastly, some have suggested that the court may be asked to enter into affirmative action again, given controversy over the way the Fifth Circuit handled the remand in the Fisher case.
Professor Vladek, you want to speak to some of the cases that aren't yet on the docket that might get there?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the denial of the same-sex marriage cases, I think, is a pretty good sign, I have to say, of how the court's going to look at a lot of these issues, which is I think they are increasingly inclined in this context to wait for some division of authority, especially on hot-button controversial issues. That's why I think John's, you know, probably right about Halbig, that, you know, there may or may not be an incentive to take the case now. There's another case, a very important surveillance case, that's currently pending en banc in the 11th Circuit. This is a case called U.S. versus Davis, and it raises the question of whether the government needs a warrant before it searches, before it obtains something called cell site location information, or CSLI. One of the things about CSLI is it's how our cell phone companies know where we are. So whenever we're talking on our cell phone pings the nearest tower for the phone company. That in turn produces data that the government could at least in theory use to track our location. The Fifth Circuit, in a ruling about 2 years ago, had held that that information is not protected by the Fourth Amendment, that we don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. The 11th Circuit reached a contrary decision earlier this year, but the government then sought rehearing en banc. And so I think the Supreme Court will very much wait to see whether the en banc 11th Circuit eliminates the circuit split before jumping into that question. On surveillance also, I mean, we have the first challenges to the NSA telephone metadata program. One was already argued in the Second Circuit. This is the ACLU case. It was argued last month before a three-judge panel in New York. The other case is being argued before the D.C. Circuit on November 4th. And this was, of course, the case that produced Judge Leon's ruling holding that the program violates the Fourth Amendment. So there's the distinct possibility that we'll have competing circuit court rulings on that question that will get the Supreme Court's attention. There's also a major challenge to the Guantanamo Military Commission that's going to be heard by a three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit on October 22nd. And so however that decision goes could get the Supreme Court's attention. So, you know, I think it's always dangerous to try to leap to conclusions about the shape of the term on First Monday because there are so many important cases currently making their way through the circuit courts. That I think we really don't have a good sense yet, especially given how much of the court's docket is still left to fill of where we're going to be by the end of the term. But certainly we could have any one of these issues, the abortion cases John mentioned, you know, how big, et cetera, up by the end of the term, which would turn what, at least for now, looks like a pretty quiet term into quite a momentous one.
All right. Before we go to audience questions, let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule of Teleform conference calls. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., we'll have a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform where we will be discussing Holt v. Hobbs. That's a case being argued in the court tomorrow that hasn't been mentioned here today. It's the Prisoner Beard case that you probably have heard about. That is tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday at noon, we'll be talking about, our topic will be why government fails so often and how it can do better. That's Wednesday at noon. Thursday at 2 p.m., we'll be visiting with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen and her thoughts on advertising substantiation. And then Friday at 1, we'll be talking about the Take Care Clause and the president's duty to enforce the law. Today, of course, we're talking about the opening of the Supreme Court term. Let's turn to our audience for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open right now. I've got a couple hundred callers this afternoon. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate you have a question. While we're waiting to see if somebody rings in, let me go back to Carrie Severino and get maybe some further thoughts from you, Carrie, on the gay marriage denial of cert. It seemed to me, both you and Professor Adler were asserting arguments about reliance with regard to Halbig and the King cases and consequent uncertainty. Aren't there some of the same issues in the gay marriage cases that the court just denied cert on?
Yeah, I think actually that's very true. It's a similar lineup of questions. It's like, well, we don't have a split here, but there's definitely the potential for a split coming down the line. And there certainly are also a lot of people who are acting in reliance on these cases, probably not the tens of millions we have affected in the Halbig and King cases, but it's clearly a very significant issue, and it's a hugely important issue in the public sphere. I think it's one that ultimately, even though they dodged it today, I think the Supreme Court is going to address it eventually, simply because I feel like eventually there probably will be a split. The Sixth Circuit arguments that they heard this summer dealing with four different states' marriage laws, I think a lot of the court watchers said there was a decent chance that they would uphold those laws. There's also the Fifth Circuit, which, depending on the panel they get, is a good bet for upholding some of those laws. So I think there's a real possibility there will be a split eventually. But certainly it's going to cause a lot of issues in between. I understand that Virginia, as of 1 o'clock, was already beginning to conduct same-sex marriages. And so you're going to have... You know, it just complicates things down the road for the question. That said, when there's not a split, it isn't traditionally something the court looks for, and I think maybe this denial indicates that they're placing particular significance on that question. Is there real disagreement? May well not take it as or not take it until there's a split either of these cases, as Stephen suggested.
This is Steve. I mean, I guess the only thing I would say about that is, you know, the reliance interests only work out if we assume that the court would eventually jump in. And I think one of the things about the denials this morning is that if they were intended for any audience, they were intended for the Sixth and Fifth Circuit panels, you know, who are currently hearing these cases, that the justices denied these appeals outright as opposed to holding them pending the resolution of what happens in the Fifth and Sixth Circuit, I think is a pretty strong message, you know, for how they hope these cases go. And now I think the real question is whether those lower courts hear that message or whether they, you know, decide nevertheless to uphold these marriage bans and set the stage for the court to have to decide.
See, that's just curious again. That seems a little like a strange procedure to me because, well, you know, on lots of issues that fly by radar, you certainly have people that have courts just letting it get solved at the district or at the appellate level and leaving it at that. I think for an issue of this magnitude, it actually would be much better for the country, whichever way the court decides, to actually have it settled at the Supreme Court rather than have this decided just by a host of courts, which, frankly, I think on the basis of a Supreme Court decision, the U.S. versus Windsor decision, that whatever your interpretation of that is, the reasoning is very, very sketchy in it, but it doesn't seem like it mandates, at least certainly from my perspective, the result that's happened. It seems like maybe it's a step toward the court deciding that the next time, but I think it would be hard to argue that the Windsor decision absolutely does mandate hands down the results that are happening, but certainly there are a lot of the judges who disagree with me. Almost seems like they're jumping on a bandwagon more than doing it as a result of being actually controlled by the precedent, however. So I think in this case in particular, it strikes me as that it would undermine the court system just have that almost a movement take it rather than letting the Supreme Court just say, here's how it is nationwide, particularly because it's not entirely clear you know, is this an equal protection rationale? Is this a due process rationale? What is the theory here? I think this is something that would be useful for the Supreme Court to step in on, you know, even if they don't ever get a split. So it would strike me as strange that they're just saying, setting a wink, wink, nod, nod, nudge, nudge kind of thing. Please, guys, hey, just keep on setting the same way. We don't have to deal with it. That That seems to me that it would be a little irresponsible for the court to decide it that way.
I mean, so this is Steve again. I guess I agree with Carrie that it would be better if we got a clear decision from the Supreme Court holding that there is a fundamental due process right or an equal protection based claim on which all same-sex marriage bans fail. But I think the notion that it's irresponsible for the court to stay out of the controversies until and unless there's a circuit split, you know, is one that is, you know, not widely accepted, and I think it would be a pretty new idea. I mean, I think this is a court that hears 70 cases a year. Most of the cases it hears are circuit splits or criminal procedure issues or the one or two cases within its original jurisdiction or the, you know, remaining voting rights and election cases that are in its mandatory jurisdiction. I don't think they're inclined to lead. I think they're inclined to follow. And I actually think in the long term, regardless of what you think the right answer is on this question, regardless of what your politics are, it's better for all of us that the Supreme Court think of itself that way, as opposed to the let's be ahead of things mantra that I think Carrie is endorsing.
Professor Vladek, do you give much weight to the fact that, as I understand it, all parties, the winners and the losers in the circuits below, requested cert? Does that weigh much in favor of granting cert?
No, I mean, if anything, I think it actually maybe undermines it because it tees up for the court as if they didn't know already, you know, exactly what's behind these cases and exactly how much this is a, you know, an invitation to the court to make a big political statement. And I think when they have to, as when their hand is forced through circuit splits or through lower court decisions that are simply, in their view, intolerable, you know, they'll do what they have to do. But, you know, I don't know that the number of people complaining, the politics of those complaining, you know, or the fact that both parties want the court to take this case would in any way have helped the argument here. I think the justices really would only have taken this case and will still only take this case if and when there's a division below or they're absolutely sure that there's at least five of them ready to go all the way and ready to actually endorse the logic of these lower court opinions. I mean, what would be worse than a cert denial would be some kind of fractured 3-2-4 result where we still have no idea what the law is going forward, at least now. In those jurisdictions where cert has been denied, it's now clear that it is legally permissible for these couples to get married.
Anybody else have any other thoughts on the gay marriage cases and the cert denials before we move on? Okay, once again to our audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open right now. A couple hundred people on the line, but no questions. So push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. Let me ask another question if any of our
I'll add one thing on the gay marriage front. One thing that I think that's worth thinking about is that not only have we had a lot of lower court decisions here, but we've had dramatic changes in the broader political environment. And I think there are a lot of justices on the court who, apart from their views of gay marriage and whether or not it should be allowed, I think there are a number of justices on the court who would much prefer this question to ultimately be resolved politically more than it is resolved through the courts. And insofar as it can delay taking a case, it at least allows the possibility that the political process will resolve this. In quite a few of the states where the laws prohibiting gay marriage have been challenged, state attorneys general have refused to defend those laws. In those states where the attorneys general are elected, the political process will get a say on whether or not that was a responsible position for them to take and whether or not the constitutional interpretation implicit in that decision is one that the voters approve of. And some other states like Ohio, where we had voters here put in a constitutional amendment prohibiting same-sex marriage. It's quite likely in the next few years that there will be a counter-initiative to remove that from the Ohio Constitution. Recent polling suggests that something like that could pass, that you know, the opinions on gay marriage in this state have swung by, it looks like, 20 to 30 points in a decade. That degree of political change might be giving some members of the court the hope that this is a significant social question that could ultimately be resolved through the political process, thereby obviating the need for the court to ever render a final judgment. And I think, you know, there are some justices on the left, like Justice Ginsburg, who think that would be preferable because of the backlash that Roe v. Wade engendered and the decades of conflict over abortion we've seen since. And I think there are probably some justices on the right who just think that that approach to dealing with contentious social issues is preferable, that it's preferable to let the political process do it. And so long as it's not clear that there's, you know, five justices that would be willing to sign a single opinion on this case, and so long as there's not a circuit split, that possibility of political resolution remains out there.
If I can just comment on that, though, I agree absolutely that everything is changing in the political process. And I think I agree with Justice Ginsburg and whoever on the right may feel that way, too, in terms of, yeah, this would be a much better issue to be resolved through the political process. What concerns me is I think that the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't gotten involved, but courts in general are involved, and it's not that they're getting involved. They have to hear these cases. So, for example, the Ohio change that you mentioned, it strikes me as strange. Maybe they'll go forward with it, but if the Sixth Circuit did overturn Ohio's law, I think you'd lose the momentum for it. Hey, let's take it out of the Constitution while we're at it anyway. Maybe you'd still get that. It just seems to me that it would short circuit to a certain extent the possibility of having that kind of closure on on the political level rather than just having the court do it themselves. So I think even if you could achieve the same result, it seems to me would have a different feel rather than, you know what, we've changed where we're going on this versus, okay, the court said we can't do that. And maybe I even think they're right, but it seems like it's a different outcome. So it's not really the political process solving it in the end, even if you let this happen, because what's happening in the vast majority of cases is not that states are going back and saying, hey, we're going to take a new look at this and let's vote again on this issue or get a new state legislature that's going to vote differently if it's a case of just a law. But what's happening is that all of the courts across the country are doing that. So I think there's the feel of it's tracking social change, I don't think it's appropriate to have the courts as the agents here instead of the actual people themselves. So even if it might track what the political results would have been if they took another vote today, I think it's still not that the courts shouldn't be coming to their conclusions because it's tracking these political wins. Now, that's not to say they all are. I think there's a risk of that appearance, however, because I think in some of the cases it does seem to appear that they're more doing a political move than a legal one. But obviously, there's room for debate on that. I just think calling what's happening now a political shift doesn't really capture it entirely because at least on the legal level, it's the courts doing it, regardless of what the public opinion may say.
But Carrie, why is that problematic if it's the lower courts, but not if it's the Supreme Court? I mean, I guess that's
I think it's problematic if it's anyone doing. I mean, I just think if it's it seems at least more closure, perhaps, if the Supreme Court's doing it. I think there's absolutely the same risk of taking it out of the hands of the people, whoever does it. I'm just saying, at this point, maybe we've already that ship has sailed. The ship of let's solve this through the political process. From it seems to me has sailed in this case because there's been too much litigation across the country of everyone has been dealing with it the other way. So it's now you can't go back.
So Kai, let me switch the topic and see if you feel the same way, right? I mean, so this morning the D.C. District Court heard oral argument in one of the more important recent Guantanamo cases. This one about the government's use of force feeding on hunger striking detainees. You know, it's been a common charge from folks on the left and from many of the Guantanamo litigators that the Supreme Court has all but abandoned, you know, the responsibility it took upon itself in 2008 in the Boumediene case because it hasn't taken another Guantanamo case since and has left all of this stuff for the lower courts. Because all these cases are in the D.C. District Court and D.C. Circuit, there's no possibility for a circuit split. So would you say in those cases the court also has an obligation to not let the lower courts have the last word, or is it just because there's only one jurisdiction you're okay letting the D.C. Circuit have the last word?
No, I guess I'm not saying that the Supreme Court has to decide every major issue. It seems to me that in this case, because of the dynamics of how it gets decided, it's gotten decided at the lower courts. It makes more sense than in most. I think it couldn't hurt to have the Supreme Court making a final call on some of those issues, particularly if they were, you know, highly controversial ones. I think it does become difficult when you're looking at a case like that where there is no possibility for circuit split. But certainly the Supreme Court does periodically take those cases, and some of them they just leave be. So because that's certainly not the only type of case that only gets decided in one circuit or almost exclusively in one circuit, preventing a circuit split. So I'm not arguing that the Supreme Court has to decide every single issue. I think in this case, because we've already stepped into the grounds of courts deciding the issue rather than deciding it in the public square to a certain extent, it probably would be healthier and simpler for the Supreme Court to have the final word. But you know what? That's not that, that I think, you know, even if it doesn't, it's very possible it's all going to work out the same way either way. At this point, whether the Supreme Court takes it or not is not the hill I want to die on. I do think that there probably will be a circuit split eventually, and I think they probably will take it. So I think the question is going to probably work itself out in the more traditional manner than the court having to say, you know, 12 circuits have gone one way, we're going to jump in. Because if they wait that long, I agree, they're probably not going to. They're going to say, look, it's pretty clear what this is, unless there's some circumstance in which the reasoning creates real issues from one state to the other. They'll probably leave it well enough alone.
Looks like we do have a question now from our audience. If you'd like to join the queue for questions, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's turn now to our audience.
Mary Ann McGrail, an attorney in D.C. Could any of the panelists elaborate on the facts and legal posture of the Military Commission's case coming up for the D.C. Circuit?
Sure. This is Steve Vladek. I'll dive on that one. The case is called Al-Balul, and for folks who have been following the litigation, this is the same case that was heard by the en banc D.C. Circuit in an opinion that came out in July. The question in Al-Balul, at its most simplest, has to do with whether military commissions at Guantanamo can constitutionally try in a military court offenses that are not recognized as international war crimes. And in Balul's case specifically, that question arises in the context of his conviction for conspiracy, which the government now concedes is not recognized as an international war crime. In July, the en banc D.C. Circuit threw out Balul's ex post facto challenge to his conspiracy conviction on the ground that he had forfeited it by not raising it below, and so it was therefore subject to only the very deferential plain error review. But the thing about the Article III challenge, the thing about his remaining claim that even Article III doesn't allow such trials, is that that is clearly jurisdictional, meaning that it won't be subject to plain error review. And so that's one of the four questions the D.C. Circuit now has to decide in its original panel, which is judges, I believe, Henderson, Tittle, and Rogers, and which is set to hear argument on October 22nd. So the basic question is, can the commissions hear non-international war crimes? And that question also comes along under Article I, does Congress have the power to create such offenses? And Article III, even if Congress has the power to create such offenses, can it subject them to trial in a military as opposed to a civilian court? Once again, arguments October 22nd, assuming we get a decision in February or March, you know, it'll probably be too late for this term, but very possibly on the court's radar for next term.
Again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask a question about a case I don't think anyone has mentioned yet, and that's Reed versus Town of Gilbert, which is a case that I'm not an expert, but it's a little confounding to me if I have the facts right. If I have them wrong, let me know. But my understanding is the Town of Gilbert, which I believe is in Arizona, has an ordinance of some sort that restricts the size of a sign and the amount of time at which a sign can be displayed in advance of a worship service to something like 6 square feet and only 12 hours of being out in public 12 hours prior to the service. Other signs, political signs and other signs, have other restrictions which are much less severe. They can be 20 square feet or whatever they are. But my basic law school understanding about restrictions being content neutral. This seems to be decidedly not content neutral. This is a case being heard later in the term. I wonder if anybody wants to comment on that. Do I have that right, or have I mischaracterized things?
This is Carrie. Those sound like it's approximately the question, and it does. It boils down to sort of the basic First Amendment question of is this law content-based or content-neutral, because that's going to determine the level of scrutiny it gets. And the town in this case seems to be claiming, even though the statute is clearly content-based, really at the basic level, it says, okay, if it's signs for this type of organization, you get these guidelines, and it's not just religious versus secular organizations. It's, you know, the political signs get this kind, and, you know, they have different boundaries for each type of content, really. So it's clearly a content-based discrimination. From my perspective, they're basically saying, it seems to me, that this is not something that's an intentional discrimination, and so we shouldn't be held to that a strict. We're not intending the law to be discriminatory. We have to categorize different types of signs because that's how it makes sense to do things. So I think that's going to be definitely an interesting case. And there's another case up for cert. The name of it's not coming to mind, but I think it's another one that covers some similar issues in terms of a different laws just for religious organizations opposed to secular organizations that could easily run afoul. It's Bronx Household of Faith versus Board of Education of the City of New York. I think that's another one that's a real interesting question of just, is this going? Can you have different rules for religious versus non-religious organizations, or does that per se violate the First Amendment? So those two both, I don't know if they're going to take this other one. They may just hold it for the Town of Reed case, but I think both of them are really going to address that key First Amendment issue.
This is Stephen. There's also, I think Carrie has that right. There's also an interesting question about the decision last term in the McQuillan versus Coakley abortion protest case, because there, you know, one of the interesting things that happened in that case was the majority ended up concluding that the Massachusetts buffer zone was actually content neutral, even though they still concluded it failed the O'Brien test. And so one of the questions I think the court's going to have to answer is whether that analysis, which was heavily criticized by some of the concurring justices, you know, is going to hold water in other contexts, whether the court is actually taking a new look at the distinction between content-neutral and content-based restrictions on speech, or that was just a compromise to allow the court to have a majority in that case.
Yeah,
very good. Go ahead, Professor Adler.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it's interesting to note here, too, that the federal government did file a brief in support of the folks challenging the ordinance, arguing that whether or not the ordinance is classified as content neutral, it should fail. The government argues that whether intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny were applied, the ordinance here should fail and fall. And so the real interesting thing to watch in this case, I think, is not going to be whether or not the town of Gilbert wins. I don't think many folks expect it to win, but the rationale that the court uses and whether or not this is another case in which the court adopts a very narrow approach and a very narrow holding, or whether or not there are five votes to do something broader here.
One of our experts mentioned the Amtrak case, and I take it this is not an opportunity to revisit Chevron, but is there any appetite, any perceived appetite in anyone in the court to revisit Chevron deference? That is the way the court reviews agency decisions. The court seems to be, after City of Arlington, sort of moving and allowing increasing deference to agencies. Is that correct? And is there any chance of dialing that back in the court, even if this isn't the right case for that, the right vehicle for that?
I would say yes and no. In a case like Utility Air Regulatory Group from last term, the greenhouse gas case, the court was somewhat deferential to the EPA, but was not willing to let it rewrite a statute. And while the court was willing to give the agency some flexibility, it certainly did not accept the agency's construction of the Clean Air Act, a construction that I think one could fairly argue was a predictable response to the court's prior decision in Massachusetts versus EPA. I think when it comes to these sorts of administrative law questions, unfortunately, the court has not shown a tremendous degree of consistency either in how it approaches the initial statutory interpretation question in terms of determining whether or not there is an ambiguity in the, or whether or not the statute speaks directly to the question at issue, nor do I think that a majority of the court really have a fully coherent and consistent view of how and when Chevron should apply. And I think Justice Scalia certainly does. He is a strong believer in Chevron. He believes Chevron should apply quite broadly. Wrote the majority opinion in the Arlington case, dissented in some other recent cases like Mead that arguably curtailed Chevron or narrowed the range of cases in which Chevron would apply. I think a lot of the other justices look at a lot of these cases within the context in which they arise rather than approaching them from a set of kind of admin law priors about how these sorts of questions should be addressed. And I think the result of that is that in any given term, you can have a case that implicates Chevron, that implicates statutory interpretation in the regulatory context, and it may have the feel or the read of a one-off because the court has not really developed a consistent and coherent approach across these questions.
And I'll just say the Helbig and King cases could theoretically touch on that as well, because that was a question a little bit, whether this even is subject to Chevron deference, because it's the IRS interpreting a regulation that the HHS also deals with. So, there's chances to roll it back in other cases, too.
Right. No, I definitely agree with that. I mean, there's this question of what do you do with a statute that is administered by more than one agency. There's also some important questions in that case about what is it that constitutes an ambiguity. And the court will often say a statute is ambiguous or not ambiguous, but what sorts of things courts can and should consider in that initial question is something that there is not a tremendous amount of clarity on, or at least not a tremendous amount of consistency on. And that's unfortunate, I think, for those that spend a lot of time in administrative law.
And that's why I think Carrie had it right off the very top of this teleform, that if there's going to be one dominant substantive field that's going to be looming over this term, I really do think it is administrative law, whether it's in the context of the Amtrak case, the Perez case, or a couple of the other cases working their way up through the totem pole. So, it's been a while since we had an admin law centric term, but I dare say it's probably about time for it.
No wonder that the press thinks it's so boring as a result.
As someone who teaches admin law, I love the idea of an admin law heavy term. I do though worry to some extent what the court does with these cases and whether or not enough of the justices recognize how the approach they take in one case implicates what they do in another. Justice Scalia, will in one case dissent strenuously about overzealous agencies, and then will turn around in another case like Arlington and write agencies a blank check. So I think that one of the dangers of there being a lot of admin law cases, in addition to the ones that Steve just mentioned, the mock mining case, where the question is, can the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission simply assert that it fulfilled its mandatory duty to conciliate a discrimination claim without any judicial scrutiny, or these other cases that were mentioned? I mean, the court could try and adopt a coherent and consistent approach to the underlying statutory interpretation questions and the delegation questions. I'm just reluctant to predict that because we haven't seen that across terms in recent years.
Well, we are up on the hour, so I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be the final word. I do want to give my deep appreciation to Professors Jonathan Adler and Stephen Vladeck and to Carrie Severino for their participation today. Certainly appreciate your insights into the coming term. And I think one of them said along the way, it's too early to say this is not going to be an exciting term. I'm paraphrasing there, and I think I agree with that. Lots can happen yet. So do stay tuned. To our audience, thank you also for tuning in and for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled teleform conference call will be tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform, where we'll be discussing the Holt v. Hobbs case. That's the prisoner Beard case. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.